Hi, everyone. Welcome to Teaching Matters Podcast. This program is produced by WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. I'm your host, Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University. You know, about a year ago, there was a lot of discussion that started at my university, and I think probably every university and most schools across the country, about what to do because of ChatGPT. I think that there was a lot of teachers that initially were questioning what the implications were for students turning in work that maybe had been informed by ChatGPT. And that conversation quickly changed to what are our obligations for helping students use artificial intelligence in an ethical and effective way. We're going to be discussing that topic and probably some others today. My guest is Carl Hooker. He's been an educator for over 25 years, holding positions ranging from a first grade teacher to a director of innovation and digital learning. Currently, he's based out of Texas. Hooker works as a consultant, workshop facilitator, and author. His recent book, Learning Evolution, The New Era of AI in the Classroom, uses expert interviews, storytelling, and descriptions of classroom strategies to help educators consider the promise and challenges associated with artificial intelligence in the classroom. Carl, thanks so much for being on.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. You know, we've had some discussions, over the last year about artificial intelligence. What I'm really excited about in talking with you is that you've actually put together research that comes from a very broad base, and we're going to delve into that. But before we start talking about your book, I always like to start these discussions with you sort of giving a non-technical explanation of what you think AI means for listeners that, you know, have seen AI in headlines, but maybe that's as far as they've gotten.
Right. And I think to kind of frame this, sometimes, Scott, we tend to let Hollywood kind of direct our thinking.
Yeah.
When we think of AI, I mean, one of the first things I do is I ask people, you know, what are some of the movies in the back of your mind where AI is the bad guy? And immediately we all fall to Terminator is usually the number one answer, Matrix. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, okay, so those are types of AI. Those are types of machine learning. And so kind of framing it in layman's terms, you know, artificial intelligence is really, it's computers and algorithms taking data that's out there and all the data sets out there, putting all that together at a rapid pace and then giving mm-hmm. us some sort of output. And so in the case of generative AI, like ChatGPT, it's, we're going to prompt it to do that output. But, you know, AI has been around for a very long time, as I get into in the book as well. I mean, I think the first time it was actually mentioned in any type of publication was 1956.
Mm-hmm. Before ChatGPT and AI became sort of a more public focal point for a lot of people, as you just pointed out, we've actually, all of us, been experiencing AI over and over again, especially since the internet, you know, rose up, and especially social media. What are some examples of ways that people have likely interacted with artificial intelligence before ChatGPT and really maybe didn't even know about it?
That's a great question. And actually, this is a great thing to pose to educators, too, when they have a sense of fear around it. I start to ask them questions like, you know, have you been on Netflix lately? And of course, all of them raise their hands, most of them. And like, have you ever noticed that it suggests things for you? Oh, yeah. Or what about Amazon? Or, hey, when you got in your car today or when you were driving somewhere that you didn't know, did you use, you know, Google Maps or Apple Maps to get you there? Well, there's AI algorithms running in the back of all of those. And so as much as you may have a fear around AI, know that it's actually been helping you behind the scenes for a long time. And as a teacher, you know, programs like Kahoot, which came out in 2014, you know, the ability to tabulate information quickly and then give me a very nice looking graph about what kids know and don't know, that would have taken me, you know, back in my old teaching days, I would have had to go home, write, you know, score the papers while we're watching Dancing with the Stars, figure out, you know, what the score, like how did they do on certain problems? And then the next day I'd come back in and tell the kids, okay, we missed this problem. Well, now it all happens kind of automatically with AI. So, I think once you show a few of those examples and teachers kind of, they lessen a little bit of their stance of that, the hesitancy toward it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned as part of your initial answer, the concept of generative AI. How did that represent sort of a fundamental shift upwards in the way that the public interfaces with artificial intelligence? What you were just describing was sort of a passive interface with AI, but generative AI is not passive at all. How is it different?
Yeah, we've gone from being the passengers in the backseat of the car of AI to now we have the steering wheel in front of us, right? So we can just direct it where we want it to go. It doesn't take a computer programmer or a coder to do it anymore. It's all just the interfaces that they designed and some of these platforms, you know, and there's hundreds of them out now. It's just kind of exploded on the scene. but the user friendliness of it, the UX of it is just, it's a lot cleaner. And it makes it to where you don't feel as intimidated by it. So putting in a few simple words all of a sudden generates a slew of ideas and art and videos and music. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, again, that would have taken a lot of processing, a lot of coding to get all that to work. And a lot of people said, well, you don't have time for that unless you're really into that stuff. So I think it's made it so easy. That's probably why it's exploding so much too, is because people can just go and play with it.
Yeah, and interestingly, I've been following the Apple potential interest yes. into AI, and one of the articles that I was reading over the weekend actually said that what used to take sort of, you know, the enormous cloud computing power of a Google or Amazon, Apple's trying to bake into their next handset, you know, the iPhone, what is it, 16
that would come out? 17X or whatever. Yeah, who knows what it'll be. They'll have some clever name for it too,
yeah, I'm sure. But so yeah. It's crazy. So just before we leave this more general discussion of AI, AI models are fundamentally based upon an underlying language model. And as I understand it, in my simple way of explaining it, the models themselves are using algorithms based upon the language data set that it has been trained on. That has implications. And so I'm sure that you've considered the idea that the algorithms that underlie the language models could have certain, for example, biases built into them. Can you discuss that a little bit?
And I think this is a very important point to bring up with anybody before you're really diving deep into AI. I always make sure to mention this in front of teachers that, you know, knowing that these data sets and these languages, as you say, they're coming from us, they're coming from humans and the inputs that we put into the internet over the last several decades. And that's what AI is drawing upon. And so one of the examples I show is like an old 1950s advertisement of it was a Schlitz ad for beer, and it says, "Don't worry, honey, you didn't burn the beer." And I'm like, that kind of, those images are on the internet. And so what does it do? It trains AI to see like, okay, there's a little bit of gender bias in that advertisement. Not a little bit, there's a lot, by the way, in that advertisement. Yeah. But that affects AI and the outcome models. And one other example I've used recently is I'll ask ChatGPT to write the wedding vows of an IT person and an educator as done in a Shakespearean language. And everyone looks at it like, oh, it's so cute the way it writes it in Shakespeare. I was like, yeah, but did you notice any biases taking place? And then they look back, they go, you know what? It assumes that the IT person is a groom and that the bride is an educator. And I go, what else did you notice? And usually, depending on where I'm at in the country, it depends. But sometimes they'll say, wait a minute. They're also presuming that it's a male and a female. And it's like, exactly. Because AI is pulling on this large data set, it goes out and finds, okay, let's see, IT professional, that's probably a male because majority of IT professionals that we search the internet are males and the educators are mostly females. And most weddings are heterosexual. So it goes through and does all that and it presumes the generality of it. And that's the bias that comes out. So I said, you have to, it's very subtle, but it does happen all the time. And you have to have that discussion with teachers, but also more importantly with students.
Yeah. And of course, the algorithms that are part of the generative AI models are similar in that respect to the algorithms that have been part of your Amazon feed or something like that. The algorithms have always been, at least as far as we can surmise, based upon data sets that may not be truly representative. Let's switch topics now, or at least get a bit more specific. In learning evolution, one of the features of that book is that you surveyed or you had interactions with over 50 experts in the topic of AI. You know, it's hard in a few minutes to sort of boil that down, but what were some of the insights that you gained from your discussion with experts in terms of what they're seeing for the future and the current state of education?
You know, it's a tricky thing because a lot of the people that I interviewed were also very, you know, very progressive, very pro AI. So I tried to balance a lot of the information I was getting to say, okay, let's talk about some of the negatives too. Because even though I'm very, you know, pro AI, and I also have concerns. And a few of the early concerns, it's interesting kind of the evolution of even the last year, I would say. You know, the early concerns were things you mentioned, you know, cheating, professors worried about that, and academic integrity, and what's happened lately is through the other, I continue to talk with experts in webinars and podcasts. And what's happened lately is there's more of a general trend toward the worry that AI is going to cause us to lose our creativity and cause us to be lazy, you know, kind of an over-reliance on AI, if you will. And that's kind of the direction that they're headed when it comes to most experts. And then talking about how do we balance that? Again, how do we teach kids the right way to use it was what it usually comes down to. But if we're blocking it because we're worried they're going to cheat, well, guess what? They're never going to get a chance to use it with us, right? At least, because we know, even if you block it, I mean, come on, kids are gonna, it says 13 plus. I'm sure no kid under the age of 13 has ever used ChatGPT, but
yeah,
they'll find a way around it. So we have to try to figure out ways to use it. So I think in talking with a lot of them, it kind of gave me a flavor of the landscape across the country in terms of where everyone was worried about. And I'm talking about professors, high school teachers, a little bit of everything. And then on the ground, I would actually do trainings over the summer with a lot of teachers of all levels, and getting over 500 different data points from them too, just in terms of what are their actual concerns. And again, it fairly aligned with what the experts said. It's a lot of academic integrity concerns.
And eventually in the book, you bring up a concept that I've studied in a different context before, but the process versus product, you know, paradigm of education. And you advocate that, especially in an AI-centered world that we're increasingly living in, that the process of education is much more important than the product. Can you unpack that perspective
for us? Yeah, and I think that's, so this gets back to the root of academic integrity and cheating. So if the question that no one wants to answer is, why do kids cheat? What is the motivation to have kids cheat? Because what we do instead is we focus on the tool. Maybe it was a calculator 20 years ago, or Google, or now it's AI. And we take the tool away, but we don't actually ever address the concern of why kids cheat. And it's a motivation to get the better grade, or maybe they're lazy or not excited about the topic, just trying to cut a corner. And so that is a problem. And then when we make our final grade a product, some sort of final product, like, oh, this is going to be the thing that we evaluate your learning on, then that's going to also encourage kids to say, okay, well, then I can cut a corner to make that final product. Now, what you can't cut corners on is the process of learning. But unfortunately, in education, because of time restraints and everything else, we generally don't evaluate process. We just evaluate that product. So what I posit in the book is, let's balance that. You know, I'm not saying get rid of product. I do think product is important. But instead of saying I'm going to throw 100% of the grade toward a final product, I'm maybe going to put a percentage toward your reflection on what you learned during the process of doing this product, or what was something you struggled with, or what was kind of an aha moment for you. Again, diving deeper into that learning process and making that also part of the grade. And I think by doing that little tiny shift, which isn't as small as I make it sound, you could actually get a better overall learning outcome and evaluation of what the student has learned. And so it also eliminates the idea that AI can cheat, because you can't cheat product with AI, or process, excuse me, but you can, of course, cheat the product.
Yeah. So sort of extrapolating that then, you know, you, with your experiences as a classroom teacher, if you were back in the classroom leading a group of students, what would your classroom look like if you were focusing on this process perspective, and maybe some of the ways that you might integrate, you know, generative AI or other AI platforms into that process?
Yeah, I think it's, first of all, it does start with modeling with what the teacher shows. And so, and again, it depends on age levels here. So if I'm an elementary teacher, obviously they're not having as much interaction with it. It's more me showing them something. Mm-hmm. I did this with a fourth grade class recently where I pulled up, I had them all write for 2 minutes. I said, all right, I want you to write for 2 minutes something you did this weekend. And they all hand wrote it. And then I said, okay, now I want you to take out your laptop, your Chromebook, and I want you to write for 2 minutes the same thing, but type it this time instead of handwrite it. And so we timed how many words per minute they were doing. And then I said, okay, now I want you to turn on speech to text. And I want you to speak into the Chromebook and have it write for you. How much further did you get? And then I said, now I'm going to pull up this tool. And I showed them ChatGPT. And I said, I want you to write about a man, because I'd just gone to my first Cubs game in Chicago at the time. And so a man from Texas who goes to his first Cubs game in Chicago, tell me a story about him. And it writes out the story. And the kid's like, wow, that was so fast. I was like, yeah, now let's go back and look at the story. And we look at it and like, now that didn't happen to me. I didn't buy the hot dog. I didn't, you know, there's certain things that made up in the story. I go, now we have to go back and clean it up. And so then the students and I would go through the process, like, let's add some more kind of spice to this, if you will, some more creativity to it. Because AI, very generic in a lot of its responses, like we already talked about, it's generalizing information. So again, that was what I would do at an elementary level. Middle school, high school, where the kids are actually going to have more access to the content or the ability to generate their own, I would use it as a scaffold. So say you're struggling with writing. Well, I did this, I'm going to admit this on the podcast now, but I did this with my 15-year-old daughter. So I'll go ahead and tell you, she's a freshman. Her teachers are going to get so mad if they hear this, but that's okay. And again, this is interesting because this is actually the reaction we have when we use AI. It's almost like a guilt. But
yeah,
what I told her was, she was struggling with a paper, it was on ethos and pathos for a freshman ELA class. And she said, Dad, I've got 3 hours to get this thing start. I can't get it started. And I was like, you know what? Like, what does your teacher say about ChatGPT? And she says, well, she's never said anything about it. And I was like, okay, so go ahead and plug it in there, get it started. And so she did. And then she copy pasted it into her Google Doc. And I said, okay, now if I'm a teacher, what I'm doing is I'm going to pull up revision history and see how much of this did you write? How much did you just copy paste? And so I did. And I said, you see this huge chunk of texture that you just pasted? I need you to reword that in your own words. And you have to understand it as well. So she rewrote it again. Mm-hmm. And then after she was done, she handed me her Chromebook. And I looked at it and I said, okay, now I'm going to quiz you on what you just wrote. I want to see how well you know the information and the content. And she nailed it. And so when she turned it in the next day, she sends me a text. I was on the road and I get a text from her and it just says, Dad, I got 100 on that ELA paper I wrote using ChatGPT. And I said, first of all, don't ever put that in writing, ever. have I not taught you anything? But also, it's not that it wrote it for you. It's that it helped you. It was a coach. It gave you the feedback. And I get into this in the book too, but I think it's that assistant, it's that thought partner. That's I've liked that kind of analogy of what it can be useful for. Because not every kid has access to, let's say, a parent at home that's willing to help them, or maybe they don't have the funds to pay for a tutor. Mm-hmm. And so now we have an equity problem, right? But if you block it, then those kids that don't have those things also don't have access to AI to help them. That's a problem.
That's a great point. I actually, interestingly, that you brought that part up. I did a video interview with one of our journalism students yesterday. Both of us are first gen, so I might be several generations above her in age, but nonetheless, we're both first gen. And we were talking about how, you know, when you're going through school, that you have to work with your parents to try to figure out the ways in which they can be most helpful for you. And for me, at least, my parents were not going to be able to help me with writing that much. They read what I wrote, but they weren't going to provide a lot of guidance like that beforehand. And that's a totally different world now, where if I was growing up in that same household, I could have a personal assistant that is virtual. And I think that's really interesting. I also find, you know, your story interesting. I was teaching a class in the fall, a freshman, and our class was focused on, it was basically an AI sandbox. And because the class is comprised of communication students, it was focused on how AI might be used in the field of communication.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting learning thing that happened, because, you know, when we started the class, I really had no preconceived notions of what it is that they would end up creating. But because so many of them were interested in things like branding and marketing, they started by thinking, well, can you use AI to, you know, create an entire social media post? Of course you can, but they were savvy enough to figure out that they could use AI on pieces of something that then they put together. And so they sort of evolved from AI as a complete crutch to it becoming more of a creative tool that sped things up for them. And I thought that was a really interesting flip to see
that
they kind of figured out for themselves.
Yeah, I think that's and I think that's where we are right now with AI. I think it's I do a challenge with educators when I call it the human intelligence versus artificial intelligence challenge. Mm-hmm. And I make them all stand up and I said, all right, I'm going to put 1 minute on the clock. You have 1 minute to come up with as many things as you can find at a barbecue cookout. Ready, go. And so them and a partner, they have to go back and forth and just name and count on their fingers and everything. And then I stop the clock and I say, oh, how many did you come up with? You know, 20, 30, maybe. And I said, now I'm going to ask AI the same question. And I have it list on the big screen. Here are all the things, 50 different items. Of course, it does it in a minute. They get 50 items. It blows everyone away. I'm like, okay, well, it's so much faster than us. I go, yeah, but now look at what it actually generated. And it's things like utensils and forks and fire and things like that. I go, what is it missing? And they always realize, it always is an aha moment for them when they realize there's a lot of, it just lacks creativity. There's no humans, first of all. There's not crying kids. There's not the drunk uncle. There's not like mosquito spray and skin knees and music. And it's like, it's almost like there's no life to what they're generating. And I said, now you see where human creativity, when supplemented with artificial intelligence, can actually be a pretty powerful thing. And it's kind of an aha moment for them too, to say, okay, this thing isn't as smart as we think. Now, this is of course the dumbest it'll ever be, because it's going to keep getting smarter. But I think that kind of leveled pairing, or that balance of human creativity and artificial intelligence, is what we want going forward. And that's kind of why I wrote the book in the first place. It's like, we need to continue to do this going forward, because the tools will change and it'll get smarter. But how do we continue to maintain that balance?
Yeah. Speaking of tools, do you have some favorite AI platforms?
Yes. Oh, Scott, where should I start? So, you know, in the large language model area, let's start there. I think, you know, I bought ChatGPT 4 long ago, did the $20 a month thing. And now that Microsoft has it embedded in Copilot, if you have a Microsoft account, I will probably stop paying for it. Although I still like to build my own kind of GPTs and play with it. So I'll keep it around. But I tell most teachers, like, don't spend $20 a month. I mean, if you have a Microsoft account, it's free. Same with DALL-E 3, which is a, you know, a great image generator. You can pay $20 a month for it or just use Microsoft Copilot. I don't work for Microsoft, nor do I get paid by them. So I'm just telling teachers this is just a free tool. For me lately, the one I've been really loving is Padlet's I Can't Draw feature, because Padlet is a tool that most educators have used over the last 10 years. It's, you know, it's ancient, right? It's a relic of education in some ways, because it's just easy for teachers to get in there, post something on a wall. But now they have the little added feature of I Can't Draw, which is you have to kind of dig for it. But what I have teachers do is a lot of art image generation challenges based around that, because for one, it doesn't require a login. And two, it's really just click, click. And now you've generated something. You've used AI for something creatively. And I like that kind of first step into things. So I would say Padlet is one I've been playing with the most lately. But yeah, you could ask me. Oh, I'll give you one other one real quick, because I'm trying to put my book in audio format. And I thought, you know what? Since this book is about AI, why not use AI?
Yeah, so, yeah.
I use 11 Labs, which has kind of been in the news lately, because if you remember the Biden phone call thing to New Hampshire, that was all 11 Labs. Is voice cloning is what it is for our listeners out there. And so I did. I trained it. I spent, you know, 20 different takes of my voice into the program and platform, had it read a few sentences, sounded just like me, sounded great. And then I put the dedication of the book, which is about 2 pages to my dad. I put that into the process first. I said, let me see what it sounds like. And it just doesn't do inflection really well. It was okay, but my voice would get really high all of a sudden for no real reason. And I'm like, why is it doing that? And so I had to scrap it, but I am kind of playing around with voice cloning a little bit. And it's been interesting to see, like, maybe teachers, we could kind of clone ourselves if we have to be in multiple places at once. You never know.
Yeah, I listen to a lot of book on tape in the car, and
yeah,
you know, it's clear that there are some books that are generated by artificial voices. And I'm surmising that, but it's based upon certain, as you said, inflections and certain words that gets pronounced just a little bit wonky, you know? But other than that, I mean, if you're not actually listening for that, which I tend to be doing more often, I guess, the book listens really well. I mean, you know, there are inflections. It does listen well, like a good book should. So I think that's interesting. One of the platforms that I've started playing around with, and am still, you know, trying to figure out how I want to use it, is the Google Notebook LM. It is similar in concept to custom GPTs that you can create in ChatGPT. In other words, you can put your own data set into it. I think that the Google Notebook is really meant more as like a, I would say, a supplement part of a note-taking process, right? If you take notes or you have meeting transcripts, you can put those into notebooks that are self-contained. Maybe you have a notebook on artificial intelligence. Maybe you have a notebook on biology or whatever, and then you can query those. So I'm playing around with that, but I think that's sort of the exciting part right now for all of us, is that many of these AI platforms have free at least entrance levels to them, and you can just play and figure out, how could I use this? I think that's very exciting.
Yeah, I think we're right at that edge where the free is going to start going away soon, unfortunately. Yeah. But because we know this, if we've been in education long enough to know that, you know, eventually the freemium goes away. But
yeah,
what you're talking about, that kind of micro language model instead of a large language model, a lot of universities are leaning on that. University of Florida most specifically comes to mind right now, because they're building out kind of a database of all the research, all the articles, everything on their websites, on their university websites, and then building out their own basic GPT, if you will, that is doing exactly what you're talking about. It allows the student to go in and query, you know, where is this? Where, you know, it's basically a quick way to kind of generate content based on a closed data set versus large language models, which of course take everything.
Right. Right. Let's switch gears one more time. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about AI because it relates to your Learning Evolution book. You also released another book in 2024, Ready, Set, Fail. The premise of that book really centers around the importance of risk taking. What do you mean by that? And let's link it back to AI. How do you think that artificial intelligence applications in a classroom can facilitate students learning to be acceptance of risk, you know, to have acceptance of risk, right, and to have a growth mindset coming out of a risk situation that maybe didn't go perfect for them.
Yeah. First of all, my favorite topic is risk taking and failure. I love AI. Don't get me wrong, Scott, but I mean, I always ask this question to people, like, have you ever failed? You know, and usually almost 100% of the time, every hand goes up. But when I say, do you consider yourself a failure? Generally, nobody raises their hand. And I think it's important to, first of all, say that, you know, we all agree that failure is a great teacher. We learn a lot from the mistakes we make. Why is it that in education, we don't find that acceptable? We don't find failure to be an acceptable phrase. And it goes back to some of the things we just talked about with AI and academic integrity. It's that pressure to get the grade. It's about the test. And when you say the word fail in that context, yes, it's very negative. However, if we say, well, I had to build this prototype and it took me 17 iterations to build it and it kept messing up, but eventually I got it. That's where the joy of learning really takes place. Like, how much of that, again, back to process, just like we were talking about with AI, that process of actually building, failing, iterating, that's all part of the learning process that I think, unfortunately, we've kind of put to the wayside because we have to get through so many worksheets or so many standards or so many tests. And so allowing that to breathe, if you will, in a classroom, I think is an important thing. So that book, I really focus on how do we generate this kind of, we almost have to manufacture a culture or a community of failure in our classrooms, because unless they're on a sports team, which only about 28% of students are actually on some sort of collaborative sports team like soccer or football or whatever, we don't experience failure individually or as a team. If we're not on those, we don't play sports. Right. And so those kids that are in the classroom, they've never experienced that. And then they go into life and they are part of a team or a project design team. And it happens to them the first time and they have no idea what, you know, how do I recover from this? Because I don't have that built-in resiliency, if you will. So it's kind of meant in a lot of ways, the book is to teach kids how to have that resiliency built in. And again, going back to the AI piece, I think that's all part of that learning process that we also need to teach them. So you can't fake that. That's something that AI can't do. We need to make sure that kids continue to have productive struggle, that worry and concern that AI will make us lazy. You know, if we continue to create opportunities for them to try something out of their comfort zone, maybe with AI, maybe without it, and then talk and reflect about what they learned during that process, I think that's so powerful because they'll remember that going forward. They won't remember, you know, the term paper or the worksheet, but they'll remember that experience.
Sometimes when I've had discussions about failure with my own students, an interesting point that comes up, you know, and sort of, and I also work with graduate students who teach. So sometimes it's a meta conversation about, you know, kind of coaching students in the classroom when you're the teacher, just like you're doing right now. One of the questions that comes up is like how you as a teacher who's trying to facilitate experiences that allows failure can calibrate the risk that you expose your students to. In other words, you can overdo it and you can have the failure be so traumatic that there is no learning outcome from it, or you can underdo it and it's sort of like, yeah, whatever. And you have to figure out where the balance is. Like how do you personally, you know, sort of analyze those situations for teachers to strike that balance?
Yeah. And I'll add a third too. That is that you can overdo grit. I think sometimes stick with it. You just got to stick with it, you know, and there's a time when you have to do what I call strategic abandonment, right? When you're like, okay, this process or this thing that I'm trying is just not working. You know, I've tried it multiple ways. I've exhausted every resource I have emotionally, physically, mentally. I'm going to go ahead and change course, you know, and there's something to be said for that too. So I think in all three of those components, when you're trying to balance this in a classroom, you have to start small. And I think the other thing you have to do is do it collectively. In other words, don't put one student in front of the class and have them try something in front of everybody. Instead, let everybody try it. So a lot of the activities I have in Ready, Set, Fail, it's a lot about let's all get up and let's all do this together. Let's all try to, you know, draw a snowman on a plate on top of our head. You know, something that none of us have really practiced, I would hope, but maybe. And then we look at the results, let's laugh and see, and then let's do it again. But let's see, what did we learn? Maybe we don't lift the pen up this time or the marker up. Maybe we keep it so it doesn't kind of move all over the place, you know? So again, teaching kids in a collective effort on a very low pressure situation, I think is the way to get started in it. And then once you get comfortable with that, and it does take a couple of weeks, it's nothing that just happens overnight. Once you create that kind of learning community, or I call, you know, a community of innovation, then all of a sudden it becomes more practiced, if you will, that students are willing to try and say new things. Because what we see in the data and the research is by the time they get to about middle school, you know, the idea of actually asking curiosity-based questions is pretty much reduced to about 0 to 2 a day on average. Hmm. When you consider a 4-year-old asks about 300 curiosity-based questions a day, which is, what do you think the number one question they ask is, by the way?
Why?
Exactly. Yeah. Why? You know, ask Alexa. That's what I say. No, I don't say that really. But I think, you know, having, you know, how do we encourage those curiosity-based questions again at the upper grades? And so a lot of it comes to what the culture in your classroom looks like. Because if a kid says something different or unusual, what happens a lot of times is they're ridiculed.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, but teenagers are really snarky. I know I was surprised when I found out too. But they do. They get sarcastic. They get snarky. And all of a sudden, it just shuts down those ideas. So again, creating a philosophy of yes and, which is, you know, something else I talk about in the book. That's a big improv tenet that Apple and Google mm-hmm. companies around the world use as well. The idea that we're going to add to your idea and not shut it down. I think that's a huge concept to have in those classrooms to make it softer when it comes to that kind of, when you do take a risk and fail, you know, what does it look like? And you don't want it to be traumatic. I agree with you, because that could ruin their educational experience for the rest of that year or the rest of their life.
Yeah. So much of it is, you know, how the teacher establishes culture and is transparent with the students about what she or he is trying to accomplish with them. And then also knowing the students. I mean, you can't teach at that level without having a appropriately close but bounded relationship with your students, you know, on an individual basis. I think all that kind of goes hand in hand.
Yeah. And I think what you just said there is so important. I mean, what our words matter so much, mm-hmm. you know, what we say, how we say it. Students are watching and listening. And so if I'm up at the board, or I'm doing something with my laptop and it's not working, I'm like, oh, this stupid technology isn't, you know, just saying something negative, yeah. immediately it puts that out there. Versus, you know, I had this experiment. I wrote about it in the book, but one thing I did is I like to guest teach at my kids' class, kids' schools, because, you know, I'm not in the classroom right now. Uh-huh. And so I want to still stay in there. So I did this, like, I did this activity with Spheros, where we're going to have these little robots run around the classroom. And I had it all planned out. It was going to be a BattleBot challenge, and it's going to be amazing, and everything was great. And then the night before, I just left the little charging block unplugged, because I figured they're already charged. I don't need to continue to plug it in, and moved it into the classroom where I'd be working the next morning. Well, the next day, everything was dead. All the spheres were dead. Mm. I didn't realize it until we got to the point of the lesson where they designed their little BattleBot cups. And I was like, in my head as a teacher, I start to panic. And I'm like, okay, I'm supposed to be the fountain of all this great knowledge, which is, by the way, that's one of the big fallacies of teaching, right? And so, what do? I just say, okay, take out your notebooks and talk about what this could have been like. And I said, but instead what I did at that moment was a big aha for me. I turned to the class, and these are third graders. It was third grade. And I said, hey, I've never done this before. This is the first time I'm trying this. And this is what happened. What do we do? What do you think we should do? And they just started leaning in and coming up with all these amazing ideas. Like, well, we could. Well, a couple of kids figured out that if you plugged them in directly to the wall, they would charge faster. And it's like, hey, we'll set up like a pit stop area and we'll just switch them out quickly. And I was like, okay, let's try it. And it ended up being one of the best. I get goosebumps actually telling the story right now. Yeah. It turned out to be one of the best lessons I've ever done, because I didn't shut it down because I failed. Instead, I said, hey, I failed. What should we do as a group? How do we recover from this failure? And I think doing that little bit of modeling, it's just a huge thing. Of course, they still remember it. My daughter was in that class. She's now that ninth grader I was telling you about. Mm-hmm. And she still says, Dad, you remember the BattleBot thing? And I was like, yeah, I know, that disaster. And they love it. They love to see Dad make mistakes too.
Yeah.
And again, as a parent, I want to model that as well. And say, yeah, I messed up big time, but look what I did, you know?
That's such a great story, Carl, because one of the ideas I've been playing around with in thinking about sort of my college's philosophy on how we work with students, because I think we have a shared philosophy, but oftentimes, and a great culture, but oftentimes it's hard to articulate what that is. And I feel like what you're describing is similar to a lot of the things that happens in our classrooms here. And one of the things that I infer is that great learning happens when the teacher at the front of the room has respect for the students, and maybe you could say trust as well, but I think that you can trust your students, but when you go to the level of respecting them, it's empowering. And what you just described was a very empowering experience for not only the students, but you. And I think that's awesome.
I think, and I learned that early on. I wish I would have learned it earlier in my career, but my first couple of years of teaching, I had mentor teachers, you know, that had the rule of you don't smile at the kids until Christmas, and you don't, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
And I didn't do that. And I even had, famously one time for me, it was during my student teaching years, I got hired on as a substitute, and I had to teach a fifth grade class that had a couple of the teachers were out due to cancer. Hmm. So I had 45 fifth graders, and I was still in college. trying to teach these kids. And I was like, I'm just going to try to keep them alive. You know, that was like my goal every day. And at the end of that, the principal's like, I want to hire you next year. You did a great job. You know, you're great interacting with the students. They like you, they respect you. But my college coordinator told me, you know, you're too friendly with the kids. You shouldn't be a teacher. In fact, you should try to think about doing another profession. I don't think you're going to be good in this craft.
Wow.
And I was like, wow. And I'm the kind of person, I don't know about you, but I get motivated when someone tells me I can't do something.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
that was like it. So flash forward 5 years later, I win teacher of the year for that campus. And I'll just tell you this and the listeners, I guess, I took a picture of my whole class underneath the big billboard that said Carl Looker, teacher of the year. And I sent it with nothing else, just to this address of the college coordinator.
As you should.
No words, yeah, nothing else. Yeah. You know, I'm Sicilian. I never forget. but you know, it's interesting. Yeah, that connection, that respect, I think what you touched on is so important. And that has nothing to do with AI or risk or any of the things. It comes back to that mutual respect. I think that's so important.
Well, listen, so we're going to be linking in the text that accompanies the podcast to your website. So for all the listeners that I'm sure got intrigued by what we've been talking about, you can go to Carl's website and learn more about his books and be able to interact with him in that way. Carl, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you were super excited to bring up today?
I mean, we hit a lot. We hit everything, Scott. I'm like sitting here going like, and then 2 days ago, I got the Sora video thing. Did you see that?
Oh yeah, I know. Well,
and especially that's a whole nother discussion, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
About what it does to the future workforce or people that make stock video footage, because now you can just have AI do it for you.
Yeah. So that was huge in my college where we teach video. You know, I mean, it just is. And to the point that you're making, I mean, how do videographers, especially that many of them work freelance. I mean, how does their role change? I mean, I feel confident that you still want a creative human involved in projects like that. But in other words, I don't think you can have just a general office worker punch something into Sora and have that all of a sudden go out over social media for a multinational corporation. But yeah, it's a big deal. So
it goes back to what we said with even generative AI in terms of a ChatGPT. It's like, I think it's still going to produce generic stuff.
Yeah.
We still need to add the human and the creative and the spicy element to it that AI can't do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Carl, it's been great getting to know you, and I hope that our worlds collide again at some point.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. My guest today has been Carl Hooker. He's an author and also a 25-year educator. His new book, Learning Evolution, The New Era of AI in the Classroom, is a great read. If you want to learn more about that book or his other recent book, Ready, Set, Fail, just follow the hyperlink that's in the text accompanying the podcast. Thank you for listening to Teaching Matters. Our associate producer who's on the call with us is Adam Rich, and our assistant producers are April Koska and Trinity Sweet. I'm your host, Scott Titsworth. Have a great day, and we hope to be back with you soon.